Welcome, everyone, to The Wide-Eyed Creative. That's me, by the way. I'm Bob Stromberg. And this podcast is here to help you awaken your hibernating creativity, understanding that creativity is not a gift that only some special people possess. No, no. Creativity is a craft, which means you can get better and better at it. And that, my friends, is going to change your life. Today's episode is in the Life on the Carousel series, and each of these episodes has the same introduction. And it's not because I'm being lazy. I really encourage you to listen to the introduction again and then again, because repetition is a great way to begin building a strong habitual neural pathway of creativity and a great way to begin to really understand the creative process. But the story that follows, that'll be new. So here we go. Gentlemen, if we could have that first slide up there, can we do that? This is a picture of the home that I grew up in when I was a boy. This is the home that I moved my parents out of just 5 years ago. This is the house that my parents lived in for 50 years, during which time they threw away nothing. I'm performing here for a large crowd. I love this piece. I'm showing people slides from my actual childhood family slideshow.
My life. Roughly 100 slides per carousel. That's 2,000 slides in no particular order.
The slides that my mom and dad and two sisters and I used to sit in the dark and watch in what seems like a different world. 30 years ago, a thought occurred to me. That's the expression, a thought occurred to me. What I actually mean is a thought grabbed me emotionally. In this case, the emotion was excitement. And because the thought grabbed me, I grabbed it back.
Well cared for. Why don't you throw it away? He'd say, no, I like your mom in that little wedge. I think she looks so pretty there.
This is the first step in the creative process. When something grabs you emotionally, you grab it back. And by that, I mean you write it down, or you type it out, or you talk it into your phone. You grab it so it can't get away.
The man who sold my mom this camera said, Lucille, you're going to love this camera. You can hardly take a bad shot. Then he took the camera, pointed at my mom, and took the very first picture.
I grabbed a thought, wrote it down. Family slides. That was it. Then I interrogated the thought. That's the second step in the creative process. You interrogate it to find the truth, to discover how that thought might be used. And if you keep at it, and in this case, with this comic piece, you're listening in the background here, I literally kept at it for 30 years.
We had a lot of these double exposures. This is one my big sister called Winter Dreams.
But if you keep at it, there comes that aha moment. Every creative knows what I'm talking about. That is the wonderful moment when a thought you've grabbed becomes an idea you can use. Then you transform that idea. Transform. That's the final step. You transform the idea into something that communicates with the world. In the case of this comic piece, the result is some pretty satisfying laughter.
This is my grandmother and my grandfather sitting on their sofa there in their living room in Glacier National Park.
That's the creative process. You grab, you interrogate, and you transform. But even as you transform your idea, and by that I mean as you create your art, thoughts continue to grab you emotionally, so you grab them back. As I created this comic family slideshow, thoughts about individual slides kept grabbing me. So I grabbed them back, and then I interrogated them. And the thoughts became an idea that I could create a file of stories and record them here so that you might enjoy them, but also so that you might come to better understand the actual creative process. I call this collection of stories Life on the Carousel. Here's one. Enjoy. So my parents entrusted me with 20 circular slide magazines, what the Kodak company called carousels.
I put one on the projector, pressed forward, and, well, these are the stories I found there. So I'm looking at slides 69 and 70. The first one is a picture of my buddy John and myself. It was taken in 1968 by my dad. It's the springtime of my sophomore year. I'm only weeks away from a major summer growth spurt during which I will add 3 inches and put on another 10 pounds. I've been excitedly and nervously anticipating this change. Excitedly because my father told me this would happen soon. Nervously because, well, he'd been wrong before. I'm sitting on the flower garden retaining wall playing my guitar. Next to me, perched on the hood of a 62 Ford Falcon, is my buddy John. He's a junior. He's 1 year older than I, and it's evident. John could easily grow a full beard and did most every day. He looks a bit like Elvis just before he got fat. I, on the other hand, look a bit like Opie just before the Andy Griffith Show got cut. We're strumming 12-string guitars, the only ones in our town. They're not identical, but they're both $75 Harmony guitars bought at a music store 25 miles away in Olean, New York. I bought mine first. John saw it, thought it was cool. A couple weeks later, he bought his own, and we started practicing. We're playing a C chord. I can see that in the picture. When it's one of the few chords that we've perfected. My dad pulls in the driveway after work. He stops directly in front of us, rolls down his window, retrieves his camera from beneath the seat, and says, "Hold it right there, guys. This'll be a nice one." And he snaps the picture. John and I spent a lot of time practicing. We met at my house most every day, and I always looked forward to his visits. They made me feel good about myself because, well, he was an impressive guy. He was good-natured, excellent student and leader, an athlete, and perhaps most impressively, he was an outstanding singer who had already experienced something of a music career. 2 years earlier, he and 4 other guys formed our town's first rock and roll band, The Changing Times, though within a month they were simply The Times. John was the front man, beating a tambourine against his thigh and screaming into his handheld mic what are now known as the rock and roll classics. Back then they were brand new. The Times had a repertoire of perhaps a dozen songs, but they could fill a couple hours easily by stretching a 3-minute song into 6 or 9 or by simply repeating it 2 or 3 times. Or they could add a drum solo, and then the length was only limited by the drummer's stamina. A drummer's skill was not particularly important or even appreciated. Speed and stamina were what was most impressive. When I was in junior high, the Times played at all our school dances. I was a huge fan, and I imagined myself being invited to join the group. This was not an entirely foolish thought. I had a good voice. It was not as mature as John's, but I had a strong falsetto. I sang harmony parts easily, and unlike John, I already knew all their songs on my starter guitar. I sat by my bedstand radio for hours, fingering the frets, searching for the chords I heard. I was surprised to discover that most of the songs used the same 3 chords. Sometimes when I was unable to find the right ones, I'd wrap an elastic capo around the guitar's neck and, what do you know, same 3 chords. With this new knowledge, I was able to create a flawless medley arrangement of Louie Louie, La Bamba, Hang On Sloopy, Twist and Shout. And I figured it out in my head. It took me about a minute. During their first year, none of the Times were old enough to drive, so they were unable to play outside our little town. This created a dangerously small marketplace for a band that had invested a fair amount of cash in instruments and equipment. They could play at school dances, but there weren't very many, and the band wasn't likely to be booked for the big ones like the prom. Other than the school gym, our town had only 2 performance spaces where a dance could be held. The first was the banquet room on the 2nd floor of the old Legion Hall. Unfortunately, after several sold-out dances, the building tipped a bit to one side. It was less than a foot, but you could see it. For several years afterwards, my little church continued to meet there for the annual Christmas smorgasbord, but dances were forever banned. The second and most viable option became the Moose Lodge. Above the bar, on the second floor, there was a fine dance floor with an elevated stage at one end. It was here that the Times built their following. I wanted badly to be in a band, but my parents forbade it. They did so not because they disapproved of the music, but because they disapproved of the Moose. Or more specifically, they disapproved of my presence in a place where alcohol was served. I think it's safe to say that teenagers attending the dances consume none of that alcohol, and I made that case to my parents. You guys are being so unreasonable, I said. The bar's downstairs. I mean, kids aren't allowed to go anywhere near it. Bobby, my mother said, we're not going to talk about this anymore. Then I can never be in a band, I protested, my voice cracking on the edge of angry tears. Then you'll have to do something else, won't you? She said. I looked at my father, pleading. He raised his eyebrows as if to say, why are you looking at me? You know your mom and I are together on this one. It wasn't long afterward that I asked my folks if they would help me to buy the expensive 12-string, and surprisingly, without hesitation, they agreed. My mom had said that I'd have to do something else. They recognized that this was it, and they were willing to help. The rock and roll classics didn't sound so good played all by myself, so I turned to folk music. I learned songs like Lemon Tree, Green Fields, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? While the other kids were rocking out at the Moose, I sang to my parents. Yellow bird, so high in banana tree. Yellow bird, you sit all alone like me. It was pretty depressing. Oh, Bobby, my mother would say, but play that one about the answer that's blowing in the wind. At some point, I decided to write my own songs, which I modeled after so many romantic heartache hits I'd heard on the radio. I'd experienced very little romantic heartache by myself, but that did not deter me. The previous year, my eighth grade sweetheart moved away from our town. Her dad got a job halfway across the country, and apparently, giving no consideration to my feelings, he decided to take it. To add insult to injury, he insisted on taking his daughter and the rest of his family with him. If not heartbreaking, the experience was at the very least profoundly unpleasant. I used the memory and I wrote a song. In the darkness of the night, I can hear your voice calling to me. In the darkness of the night, I could see your face smiling at me. And then it makes me wonder why you'd leave me all alone. Now I know what it's like to be on my own. And there was a chorus, which is far too embarrassing to reproduce here. It was a poor song conceptually, structurally, and lyrically, but it had a nice melody, putting it right on par with just about anything by the Archies. In retrospect, I'm amazed that I stood in our living room and performed it for my parents. I'm even more amazed that they didn't laugh, though they may have lost it when I left the room. Mom, Dad, I said, I wrote a song. You want to hear it? Sure, my father said. Let me turn down the TV. I remember no embarrassment, even when I knew my sister Sally was listening in the hallway. She was a tremendous tease, but I didn't care. I sang like my heart was breaking. When I finished, my parents clapped. Sally, with a huge smile, walked into the room. I was ready for ridicule. Oh my gosh, she said. Did you write that? Yeah, I said defensively. So what? Because, she said, it was so good. I can't believe you wrote that. Took me a moment to realize she was sincere. Shortly afterwards, my choral director asked me to play my guitar for our Christmas concert. Following a rehearsal, I sang a few lines of my new song for some friends in the music room. I heard someone harmonizing behind me and turned to see John. I stopped singing. Cool guitar, he said. I've never seen a 12-string. Yeah, the birds play guitars like this, I said. You can hear the sound on turn, turn, turn. No kidding, he said. Where'd you get it? Olean, $75. Cool, he said. Hey, play that song again. And that's how our friendship began. I'd always known who he was, but in the elementary years, not many friendships crossed grade levels, and he lived on the other end of town, literally and figuratively on the other side of the tracks. His house was a poor structure that I did not often visit. When I did visit there, his mom was as sweet as could be, always smiling, often cooking or ironing in their cluttered kitchen. His father was sullen and distant. My only insight into their family dynamics came one day riding in John's car. He was driving backwards. He'd been doing so for nearly 3 weeks while he waited for a part to fix his transmission. It's amazing how good you can drive, I said. You're so relaxed. You act like you've been sitting behind the wheel your whole life. Well, that's because I have. What do you mean? You just got your license last year. Yeah, he said, but I've been driving since I was 7. He went on to tell me the story of his dad leaving him in the car while he went into a bar. A couple hours later, his dad returned and fell asleep. John, only a second grader, drove him home. Most often we practiced at my house. After a year or so, we had a repertoire of our own and shared it wherever we could. We played at some private parties, won our school talent show, even a late-night serenade of a pretty girl from beneath her second-story bedroom window. One day after school, my mother handed me an advertisement she had cut from our local paper. "Take a look at this," she said. It was an announcement for a talent show being held by the Wellsville, New York Art Guild. Auditions were the next weekend. "You and John should try out," she said. "There's a $100 first prize." "Mom," I said, that sounds great, but Wellsville is over an hour away and John's car only goes in reverse. Even I think that trip would be too risky." "I'll take you," she said. And she did. A week later, we stood before a small table of judges and sang two songs, my original and somewhat improved In the Darkness of the Night, and a traditional railroad song. "In 1841, I put my corduroy breeches on, I put my corduroy breeches on to work upon the railway." They told us on the spot that we were in. 3 weeks later, we stood on a stage in a full high school auditorium. We sang our best, and it was the best we'd ever sung. Then we sat down backstage on folding chairs. With each act, we began our victory celebration. One little girl tap danced while lip-syncing Me and My Shadow. She was cute as can be and no threat. An older woman attempted a classical piano piece but succumbed to stage fright, skipped a movement or two, and played the last chord 4 or 5 times maybe before getting it right. It was sad, but hey, that's show business. One old man played several harmonicas poorly before swallowing a tiny one. It was deliberate. He tied a string to it. I later overheard a judge arguing with the man. "Yes," she said, "I understand that it is a unique talent, but it is gross." With the conclusion of each act, we were spending our prize money. Then the announcer said, "Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome our final contestants? First prize winners for the previous 2 years, the pride of Wellsville, our very own, the Liberty Boys." The audience went crazy, as did the judges in the first row. John muttered a mild expletive. From the other side of the stage, 4 young men bounded into the spotlight. They were dressed in sharp black trousers, red and white striped shirts, and sparkly vests. They carried a tambourine, tenor guitar, banjo, and upright acoustic bass. They began with a ballad. All 4 sang in near perfect unison. "Today, while the blossoms still cling to the vine, I'll taste your strawberries, I'll drink your sweet wine. 1,000,000 tomorrows will all pass away ere I forget all the joy that is mine today." It was beautiful, and I felt the joy that was mine disappearing. Before my eyes, I saw our blossoms falling from the vine. The audience sat in rapt attention and at the end burst into applause as the Liberty Boys strummed into the introduction to This Land Is Your Land. By the second line, the audience had risen and they were singing along. John leaned closer to be heard. "How much was the second prize?" he said. "Do you remember?" "Just a trophy," I said. "But hey, don't give up. They could still blow it." But I was wrong. They were far from blowing it. At this point, they could have shouted vulgarities at the judge. They could have gestured lewdly. No one would have cared. And they weren't done. When the audience joined in the last chorus, the bass player began spinning his instrument, revealing the red, white, and blue of the American flag painted on the backside. Presumably, they were still singing, though the audience was too loud for us to be certain. John shouted, "Was second prize two trophies or just one?" It was just one. A gold-painted Olympic athlete with garlands standing upon a wooden pedestal. It was terribly generic, and in that respect, much like the Liberty Boys. But hey, I have to give them credit. They knew something about showmanship that we had not learned. They knew their audience, and they connected with them big time. After graduation, John went to college somewhere around Harrisburg. He met a girl there, fell in love. He asked me to be his best man. The night before the wedding, we shared a hotel room and talked far into the early morning hours. I wanted to express how much I appreciated his friendship. I wanted to say, "Thanks for being such a good friend." I don't know why I couldn't find the words. "Hey, John," I said, I can't believe I'm your best man. That's cool." That much was the truth. It was cool. He had a lot of good friends. He could ask any of them, but he asked me. It was a great honor. Sadly, the marriage was brief. I saw him only one more time, maybe 5-6 years later. I was visiting my folks and heard that John was in town. I gave him a call, and he came to the house. We tried to sing some of the old songs, but we agreed that we didn't sound so good anymore. And by then, I considered my early originals to be embarrassingly bad, which they were. It was good, though, to be together again. That was some 30 years ago. I think everything in our lives, everyone makes a difference. I admired my buddy John. I was impressed with his charisma and talent, and so pleased that he wanted to create something with me. Our friendship gave me confidence. It helped me to believe that I might actually be really good at something, that I might find a way to do it someday. I have a slide of John. I dropped him off after school. My dad's camera was on the seat. I grabbed it, pointed the lens out the window, and shouted, "Hey, Elvis!" John spun around, smiling, and I snapped the picture. He's standing in the front of his house. It's a rundown setting, and the slide is gritty. The film is damaged, the sky eaten away by some chemical whim. Swirls of light encircle him like streamers. The lens catches him in the middle of some inadvertency. I remember thinking at the time that he looked like a rock star. I still think he does. This is Life on the Carousel.
And the sun was shining as I was strolling.
And that's our podcast, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. I hope you were in some small way encouraged, entertained, inspired, or enlightened. And I hope that you're beginning to experience an awakening of your creativity. Maybe not yet, you say? Well, then I hope you'll tune in again. Or if you want to go deeper, you can check out my online course, Mastering the Craft of Creativity. It will change your life, I promise. In fact, I guarantee it. You can check it out at bobstromberg.com/wide-eyed. I'll have that in the show notes as well. And it would be so helpful if you would rate this podcast on iTunes. I mean, if you liked it. Otherwise, you can just keep your thoughts to yourself. Until next time, you, my friend, were made to create. It is woven into your very genes. Let's make it so.